From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. In spite of today's rain, the drought situation in southwest Florida is still severe. Wildfires continue, farmers are fretting over livestock with nothing to graze on, and meteorologists are looking ahead for some relief. We'll talk about that climate forecast, check in with fire mitigation experts about the special dangers of bone-dry conditions, and talk with agricultural extension agents about the impacts seen on area farms. Plus, they're called the Jongmadong Generation, also known as the Market or even the Black Market Generation. They're the youngest generation of North Koreans, millennials in one of the most unusual countries in the world. A new documentary screening tonight at Florida Gulf Coast University peels back the headlines about North Korea's missile programs and military to talk about the humanitarian crisis the North Korean people face and why this youngest generation in what's been called the Hermit Kingdom may be the best hope for change. First, the news. This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. North Korea often makes headlines for launching missiles and its fiery rhetoric that sounds like a nation poised for war. But behind the ruling elite is a nation of nearly 25 million people facing one of the most prolonged human rights crises in history. But a new generation of North Korean millennials may be changing that. Later on in our program, we'll talk with a local group focused on the people of North Korea and a new documentary screening tonight at FGCU that sheds light on this black market generation and how it's changing one of the world's most isolated countries. But first, dry season this year has been more dry than average, following 2 years of more rain than usual. This combination has led to more issues for fire mitigators working to lessen the threat of wildfires. It's also making things tough on cattle ranchers in search of grazable land for their cattle. Vegetables love the dry, sunny weather, though, and production is so far up that prices are down. Florida's weather has always been one of extremes, but in recent years, it seems those extremes are a bit more pronounced. And today, we're talking with Florida Public Radio Emergency Network meteorologist Jeff Huffman, who joins us now. Thanks for being on the show today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Also here to discuss the agricultural impacts of a drought like this is Gene McAvoy with Hendry County's University of Florida IFAS office. Thank you for joining us, Gene.
Glad to be here, Julie.
And also to talk about the unique situation a drought brings to wildfire risk and containment is Samantha Quinn, who is a wildfire mitigation specialist with the Florida Forest Service. Thank you for coming in.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
We are talking about the drought in southwest Florida, which is in stark contrast to the situation just 1 year ago. Do you have a question or a comment? Give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. First, meteorologist Jeff Huffman, how bad is the current drought situation in Florida?
Well, it is severe, especially across portions there of southwest and south central Florida. And these deficits began back at Hurricane Matthew. Many locations in Florida recorded their top five driest winter on record. And in some locations, including where I'm located in Gainesville, we've had a deficit of over 11 inches. Now, this was prior to this week, but nearly a foot deficit in rainfall since early October.
Yeah, we got a little bit of rain today, but it was kind of disappointing. It was a very small amount, like one little downpour. Is there any other foreseeable relief?
Well, this is the time of year that these fronts that come in, such as the one that came in this morning, tend to weaken considerably as they approach the south and central parts of Florida and really in the southeast. So any rain this time of year is welcome news, especially when you're in a drought. But I don't see the overall weather pattern changing much. Typically, April and May are two of the driest months of the year in much of the Sunshine State. And so even if rainfall is expected to return to normal, and I do believe it will return to, quote, normal, you have to keep in mind that these are two dry months ahead of us until the rainy season begins.
Yeah, and we're drier than normal now. So it seems like last year at this time we were just underwater. There was so much water, and now we're incredibly dry. Is this kind of pendulum swing to extremely dry normal? Because it seems extreme to me, just as a regular layperson walking around.
Well, the cycles of going from a dry period to a very, really wet period is not uncommon. And actually, because we were in an El Nino 2 years ago, that really impacted our winter, our cold season. Last winter, a lot of the drought or not drought situations in Florida hinge upon the cold season rainfall. We typically get, of course, our rainiest months of the year from June to October, and then the winter, of course, it's typically fairly dry. In the El Nino a couple of years ago, that typically correlates to above normal precipitation in the southeast and in Florida, and it was right on cue. We had a very wet winter, and then we entered into quickly a La Nina, which is the cooling of the eastern Pacific waters opposite of El Nino, and that correlates strongly to a warm and dry winter in the Sunshine State, and we certainly had that this year. So maybe in terms of the extremes, this has been a little bit of an extreme flip, a really quick flip, if you will, but in terms of the cycles that we can have a year or two above normal and then followed by a year or two below normal, that's not uncommon.
Yeah, I'm just maybe working on a not a very long memory. But Gene McAvoy, you've been ranching here in Florida for more than 40 years. Does this pendulum swing kind of seem normal to you?
This is fairly normal, Julie. I'd point out just a couple years ago in 2008, Lake Okeechobee fell to its lowest level ever, and we were in the middle of a several-year prolonged drought. So we were glad to be out of it the last few years, but it's a cycle that repeats itself, and we've seen this over and over again.
Yeah, and you keep a close eye there on Lake Okeechobee because that's going to dictate what happens down the road for ranching out in Hendry, correct? Seems like your phone's kind of cutting out there. what is the situation right now for farmers in Hendry County?
Well, it depends what you're growing. For cattle ranchers, the situation is getting pretty desperate. We depend on rainfall to keep grass green, to provide forage for our cattle, and we are pretty much running out of pasture for those animals and having to dip into our pockets to buy feed to supplement the natural pasturage.
And then there's citrus and vegetables out there. How are they doing?
Citrus and vegetable, we, you know, always expect to have dry winter, so all of our farms are irrigated, so we're equipped to, you know, provide water during these deficit periods. The danger with citrus and vegetable is that if the lake level goes too low, they'll impose water restrictions. Right now we're at 12.4 feet above sea level. Once the lake hits 12 feet, South Florida Water Management will start to impose restrictions on growers. So that's a concern going forward. Also with citrus, we're suffering from greening right now, which impacts the root system, compromises the ability of the roots to extract water from the soil. So when we get into these extreme drought situations, it's going to impact yield. And already we've seen USDA lower their projected forecast for total harvest this year from 69 million to 67 million boxes, and that's largely the effect of drought.
Yeah, drought added on to the greening makes it even tougher.
That's so, right. It stresses the trees.
Yeah. So, Samantha Quinn, as a wildfire mitigation specialist, I imagine you keep an eye on the moisture conditions pretty closely, but is there a marked difference in fighting fires when there's a drought year?
Yes. Anytime that you have weather that is warmer than average, you're going to have situations where the vegetation dries out, and so anytime a wildfire does spark in that area, it's going to allow it to quickly spread because everything in that area is either dried or dead.
It's just like kindling out there.
Yes.
So since January 1, almost 1,300 wildfires have been reported in Florida, burning more than 56,000 acres. Currently, the Cowbell Fire in Big Cypress National Preserve is 449 acres in size, and it's 10% contained. The overall big picture, how does this compare to years past?
This year, for our district alone in Southwest Florida, we have actually seen a drastic increase in wildfire response from our agency. So we're actually trying to educate the public and move forward with things that the public can utilize to help us help them in the event of a wildfire.
And then we just came off of two really wet years.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have all that kind of rainfall, that's going to allow the vegetation to go crazy. As we know in Florida, things do grow, especially
yes.
when it rains like that. So after 2 years of things growing like crazy out there, and then this year, all of that extra vegetation is now dead and dry.
Right.
Does that make it even harder having come off of two wet years?
Yes. So typically Florida, first of all, is naturally a burning state. So our ecosystem thrives on fire. So before people were actually living in the state of Florida, lightning fires were common. a lot of the ecosystem thrives on fire. Pine trees, saw palmettos, things of that nature need fire in order to survive, or even like ghost orchids, things of that nature. So because we naturally need fire, we see these cycles sometimes. So last year, the last 2 years, it's been very wet. So we've had this uptick of growth. Well, now it's really dry. So what happens with all that growth? It's going to die off. And so when those wildfires do come through, the intensity is going to be greater. And fighting that fire and containing it becomes an issue at that point.
So when you have a dry year, you don't have as much lightning, correct?
Correct.
So you're not going to have as many lightning strikes causing the fires. Is it mainly people that are doing this now?
Yes. There's two types of wildfires. One is natural and the other is man-made. So man-made
Sorry?
Well, I was going to pop in. Sorry, I was getting interrupted.
No,
go for it.
Well, I was going to pop in about the lightning-induced fires because, yes, we're in a lull of thunderstorm activity, but I think one thing to point out is that the severe drought, or at least the moderate to severe drought, is likely to extend into May, which is right up against our rainy season, and there probably will be a period of time in late May when we start to get those thunderstorms, but we're still in a very dry situation, and so I just wanted to mention that lightning is not a concern now. It could be right before we actually flip the calendar into the rainy season.
Correct. Yeah, that kind of makes me scared going right into rainy season when things are just so dry.
Correct. So typically right now we're seeing a lot more man-made caused fires. But as soon as the thunderstorm does come through and lightning does come out, the lightning will hit the ground. And because it is so dry, you'll see a lot more as the month progresses.
And then people may totally unknowingly cause a fire by running a hot car over some overgrown brush or something like that.
Yeah. So a man-made fire can be intentional or unintentional. So sometimes it could be as simple as a campfire. You turn your back and a stray ember got out, and then it could cause a wildfire. Or driving an ATV through tall grasses, the heat from the hot engine could easily ignite the dry, tall grass.
So, and you kept on going, so you have no clue that just happened.
Exactly. So right now the concern is to educate the community on the little things that they can do to be aware of, because if the residents are aware of the things that they can do to reduce wildfire, then that helps us respond to an actual incident and quickly contain that wildfire.
And, you know, we always know the no-brainers. Don't throw your cigarette butts out the window.
Correct.
And don't leave a campfire unattended. But there's unintentional things. Like, first of all, you mentioned the ATV going over high, dry brush. Mm-hmm. And then you also said that a lot of people have a problem understanding that their charcoal grill is still smoldering there.
Correct. About 2 weekends ago, we had an individual wildfire response where there was a gentleman who had some, I guess, charcoal that he thought was out and just kind of threw it out, and it actually caused a small fire. Nothing was threatened. We were able to quickly contain the fire, but it's just the little things. Make sure anything that could be hot, make sure it's dead out, cool to the touch before you do anything with it. Make sure it's over dirt, on hardscaping and things of that nature, so that you're not intentionally causing something accidentally.
Yeah, and meteorologist Jeff Huffman, is the routine of having wet and then dry years kind of nature's way of making sure that there are wildfires? Because as Samantha mentioned, there are a lot of plants that are native here, and they depend on these fires.
Well, I could never speak for nature's intent, that's for sure. I could get myself in trouble for that. But the cycle back and forth makes sense from what we call a teleconnection standpoint, meteorologically speaking. This is a cycle. When it comes to El Nino and La Nina, for example, and that's just one of many cycles that we study, that is something that since 1950 has been very pronounced, and now is almost textbook. It's becoming very easy to identify which cycle we're in and which type of winter or cold season we're heading into. So I would say it's been happening all along, but we're just learning more and more about it every time it happens.
We are talking about the extensive drought that we're seeing in Southwest Florida and throughout the state with our guest Gene McAvoy with the Hendry County Agricultural Extension Office of IFAS, Samantha Quinn with the Florida Forest Service, and meteorologist Jeff Huffman with the Florida Public Radio Emergency Service. You can become part of this conversation, too, by calling 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK, or you can find us on Facebook at WGCU Public Media, or on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag of GCL. Gene McAvoy, irrigation works for smaller vegetable farms, as you mentioned before, but as we were talking, cattle ranchers are looking at livestock that they only have dried up grass nubs to nibble on right now. And the pastures are too far reaching for people to be able to afford water getting to that area. So how much rain would be needed to get that grass and those pastures growing again?
We would like to see several inches of rain. You know, right now, the little bit of rain that we've been getting, half inch here and half inch there, with the high heat and winds that we've been experiencing, that goes away in a day or two. That really doesn't do anything. We need a good soaking rain over, you know, an extended period of time. As I say, 2 to 3 inches would be very welcome. We really need more than that.
So if you get a couple of days of 2 or 3 inches a day, how long is it going to take that grass to come back?
Actually, it comes back pretty rapidly. The grasses that we grow here in Florida, like much of the other vegetation that grows in Florida, is adapted to the wet and dry cycles. With bahia grass, which is our most common pasture grass, it seems sometimes like almost overnight, 2 to 3 days, and it'll green back up and start growing again.
So what recourse do cattle ranchers have at this point? I mean, they don't have anything but dirt out there. They have to go out and buy feed?
We buy hay. We buy other kinds of feed. Yeah, and that impacts cattle ranchers in particular because the return on ranching is very small. It takes about 6 to 8 acres to raise a cow and its calf, and you probably generate about $40 to $50 a year profit on each acre that you run cattle on. So once you have to start buying feed, a round bale costs $50 a bale these days. You can rapidly, you know, eat into your profit margin. And for small ranchers like myself, a year like this, I probably won't make any profit.
Yeah, but I mean, is the cattle economy one where a successful or a larger producer could be more susceptible to a bad dry season like this?
Well, a larger producer typically has more land, so they may have, you know, the ability to move their cattle around. But it impacts all ranchers when we get into this type of situation, and it's going to impact profits this year.
Well, and another thing that comes up is the vegetables. They like the sun, and they're usually irrigated. So what's happened to the tomato crop? I mean, I guess it's booming, and that could be seen as good news. But what does that
mean? Yeah, it sounds like it's good news. It's been an ideal year for vegetables in terms of we've had a relatively warm, mild winter. We haven't had a lot of wind and rain to damage the crops. And as a result, we're experiencing bumper crops. And as often happens in the vegetable industry, the law of supply and demand kicks in. And when you have such a high supply, it pushes the prices down. We're experiencing a horrible year in terms of prices for most of our vegetables.
So tomatoes down to $5 a box. What does it cost?
$5 a box for an extended period of time. People are actually plowing down acres of vegetables around South Florida right now.
Because
it
costs them more money to get it to market than what it costs to grow it.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Once you hit the point where it costs more to harvest it, pack it, and put it in a box than it does, then you can get return on that box. It makes no sense.
Well, that's just a straight-up loss for the vegetable farmers out there then.
It's going to be a tough year for a lot of vegetable farmers.
Wow. So what about the sugar industry? Does that get impacted by this much?
Not as much. Sugar is a little more resilient than most other crops. They do have irrigation as well. Again, the danger is in the long run, if we don't get the water back in the lake, most of the sugar cane is irrigated from surface water, primarily from Lake Okeechobee. If the lake doesn't go back up, we will see, again, restrictions on water use, and growers will have to decide to abandon some of their acreage.
Yeah. That's a tough decision, I'm sure, that they have to make on a year like this.
Sure.
So I want to get back to the wildfires. Samantha Quinn, as a fire mitigation specialist, you're the mitigation, which means trying to make it not happen. So
yeah.
When you're looking at these kinds of conditions and everything's dry out there, what kind of preventative measures can you guys take as, for these larger wildfires? What kind of things do you do?
There's two things that we do for mitigation. One is prescribed burning, and the other is mechanical mitigation. So we actually just launched a new app called Florida Burn Tools, and it has all the information on there for burn authorizations, the drought index, anything that the public needs to know about to help educate them on what exactly is going on with fire. And so we're trying to really help educate the community with that. But back to mitigation work, prescribed fire is actually really good for our ecosystem. The problem is that sometimes maybe it's in an area that we are not able to burn in. So it could be in a smoke-sensitive area or something near hospital. So sometimes we'll come in at that point.
Yeah, and probably not good next to the asthma treatment center.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So then we come in with mechanical mitigation. So we'll utilize a bulldozer, and what we have is a drum on the back with these really cool long blades on the back. And so we'll go over and utilize the drum to reduce the height of saw palmetto or vegetation so that when a wildfire does come through there, it reduces the height and the intensity of the wildfire and allows for our agency as well as the local fire department to quickly contain that fire. So
you knock down the stuff, kind of draw an outline of we don't want it to go past here, knock everything down in that area.
Well, we utilize a containment line whenever we're trying to contain a wildfire. When we utilize mitigation work, it could be like, for example, in Golden Gate Estates, you have blocks. So we'll go through and utilize the roller chopper over areas through those blocks.
Tell me a little bit about saw palmetto. I was really interested to hear about that.
Well, like I was talking about, Florida is a naturally burning ecosystem. So a lot of the vegetation that we have need burning. Saw palmetto is one of them. So typically an average height of a saw palmetto should be around 4 to 5 feet. We're seeing in areas that fire has not touched 12 feet, 15 feet, and they should max out at 7 to 10 feet. And we're seeing them at height that is astronomical. So when a fire does go through there, the height and the intensity of that fire increases greatly. And the risk also increases, not only for our first responders, but also for the community and the damaging effects of the fire.
Well, when it's sticking way up there and you get some wind, it'll pick up one of those fronds and just deposit it somewhere else down the road.
Spot fires are always a concern,
Yeah, that could be scary. Mm-hmm. So meteorologist Jeff Huffman, did we see much lightning with the front that came through the state today?
For Central and North Florida, yes. I think it waned quite a bit as it moved into Fort Myers. We've had two events here in North Florida that produced a lot of rain. I wish I could send you guys some of it. We had some locations, in case you didn't know, up near Lake City, had 12 inches of rain on Tuesday. And so the new information, I just wanted to share that, came out from the U.S. Drought Monitor Index, and much of North Florida has improved, but it has unfortunately gotten worse there in South Florida, Southwest Florida in particular. And I also wanted to add, there's no way for me to quantify this, but I know that the weather pattern we've been in recently has been windier than normal for this time of year. I mean, the weather systems are moving very quickly across the state and across the nation, and so it causes an increased pressure gradient. And it has certainly been windy, very windy at times, which I know has added to the problem.
So you mentioned earlier El Niña and La Niña, and those are the predictors that kind of give us a more forward-looking glance at climate rather than individual weather events?
Yes, and it would be almost unprecedented if we flip again within the next year to an El Niño. There's not a lot of confidence on this. I'm actually in South Padre Island, Texas right now at the National Tropical Weather Conference, where Colorado State's Dr. Phil Klotzbach has just released his first seasonal forecast. And part of the Atlantic hurricane season may be affected by another flip to El Nino this fall, but confidence is low on that. That would be good news for Florida moving into next winter. It would likely give us higher than normal rainfall, but there's really not a strong signal right now as to where conditions may go in the next 3 to 5 months, other than just looking at climatology, which says we're going to be dry through May, and then we're going to get wet a lot of wet days ahead in June.
So you just mentioned that the Atlantic hurricane forecast is out. What's it look like?
Well, from Colorado State, it's usually the first one of the year, and he's predicting slightly below normal activity in the Atlantic. Last year, the forecast was for near normal. We ended up with slightly above normal activity. And, of course, in relation to Florida, we had two significant impacts from storms. But right now, his forecast is for 11 named storms, 4 hurricanes, and those numbers come in just below the 30-year running average for the Atlantic Basin.
So it looks like it's not going to be incredibly active this year.
I would caution him saying that, because he also mentioned to me that confidence is a little lower than normal on his forecast, because we are in this a transition year in those signals between El Nino and La Nina. But, and of course, as always, we want to remind our listeners that we all know it only takes one storm. So we always prepare the same, but at least for what it's worth, the first forecast this season from one of the more respected forecasters, you know, the successor to Dr. William Gray of Colorado State, Bill Klotschbach, predicting slightly below normal activity.
Okay. So, Samantha, you're a fire mitigator on the large scale, but what kind of tips can you give to the average homeowner trying to limit their exposure?
Right. Well, as we just talked about with wind, we recently had the wildfire down in Collier County, Picayune, Strand State, for the Lee Williams Road fire. And because of the wind, we saw that the fire was moving at such a rapid pace, we had to do a lot of evacuations.
Yeah, that was bad.
Right. So one of the programs that we promote is Ready, Set, Go. So the ready part we have is utilizing FireWise principles before a fire is in the area. The set part is having your paperwork, your animals, everything like that set so that when the go comes, you can just get out. Mm-hmm. By evacuating, you're allowing the first responders not to have to concern themselves so much with protecting you as an individual, but able to battle the fire. You're allowing them to hone in on what they're there for, which is battling that fire and then saving your house. So we encourage if the fire department or the police department ask you to leave or evacuate, it's important to do so.
Is it a good idea now that we don't have we can still run our irrigation at our houses in most areas in Southwest Florida. Is it a good idea to make sure that your grass is in good shape and keep it watered? And then if you are forced to evacuate, mm-hmm. can you leave your sprinklers on?
One of the things that we really promote are FireWise principles. And FireWise principles encourage 30 feet of lean, green, and clean space. So if there's any way that you can have the area irrigated, that would be fantastic. And the 30 feet allows for the structure department to come in there to do structure defense, allowing also our bulldozers to get in there to put a containment line around the home. So you can go to freshfromflorida.com and get all those tips on what you can do to make your home safer.
And did you see the picture of the person in Kansas who left their sprinklers on?
I did. We just had an example of that in North Fort Myers. We had a 10-acre fire in North Fort Myers, and the homeowners, the residents, turned on their sprinkler system, and it actually put out the embers that flew into their yard. So it is important that if you are able to do that, please do so.
Yeah, unless there's been a water shortage issue problem, and then you can't, and then you'll get in trouble.
Right.
All right. Well, I want to thank you all for talking to us about all of these many factors. We'll keep an eye on all of them. Of course, we'll be keeping an eye on the Lake Okeechobee levels, which is going to be pretty critical in Hendry County, Gene, as you were mentioning. Can Lake Okeechobee, if it does get low, is that going to have an impact on future years, like next year?
It can. As I say, in 2008, we had a several-year drought, which we had water restrictions were in place for an extended period over 2 to 3 years.
All right. Well, we'll be...
So, yes, it can happen.
Well, we'll keep an eye on all of these factors. Of course, in June, we'll be complaining about the rain, probably. But
I'll hear it, I'm sure.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there for now. I want to thank you for joining us. Samantha Quinn with the Florida Forest Service, Gene McAvoy with Hendry County Agricultural Extension Office, and meteorologist Jeff Huffman with the Florida Public Radio Emergency Service. Thank you so much for all of the insight, each of you.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Coming up, a documentary screening tonight at FGCU aims to shed light on North Korea's black market generation. It's the new group of millennials that are slowly bringing change to one of the most isolated nations on the planet. That's next.